Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome to Turn the Page. I'm Jen, one of your hosts for today. I work in media, and I'm here with my media colleague.
Hey, I'm Jessica. Nice to meet you.
And we're both here with an author of whom we are both huge fans. This story started several months ago when I was asked to blurb this book, and I got totally spoiled. I just blurbed my favorite book, like the first time I'm asked. It's all downhill from here. This book is fantastic. And we finally got together an interview. So could I ask you to introduce yourself and your wonderful book, please?
Thank you so much for the kind words and for the wonderful blurb, which absolutely made me so happy. My name is Kelsey James. I'm author of The Woman in the Castello, which is set in Italy during the Hollywood on the Tiber era, so 1960s, and it tells the story of a young starlet cast in a horror movie that starts to seem a little bit too real. So really fun gothic suspense where you can kind of blur the lines between what's real and what's not real. And she arrives in Rome with her ailing mother and two-year-old daughter for her big break, but she finds herself very quickly in desperate circumstances when her movie is canceled. And so she seeks out her mother's estranged sister who lives in this crumbling castle on an eerie lake. And so that's sort of what sets the book in motion and is her contact with her estranged aunt and what unfolds from there.
Ooh, it is so much fun. And, you know, when this book fell into my hands, it just immediately ticked so many of my boxes because before I came to libraries, I was a medieval historian and I wrote a dissertation on Southern Italy, like on the Norman invasion of Southern Italy. That was great. Jessica and I curate film for the library, so we're constantly wrapped up in film. And like, we're both huge, huge horror movie fans. And I in particular love giallo film. And like, that's, you know, a lot of that's at work here too. So, oh gosh, yeah, you had us at hello. Like, so if you could just tell us a little bit maybe about your journey to this book. And if you could touch on maybe your travel writing too, because I read that you did do travel writing. And I'm wondering if that's why this book has such a vivid sense of place. Like, it really brings this, the castle and its environs to life.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. I was a travel writer and editor for many years toward the beginning of my career. And I think the first spark of inspiration is often the setting for me. And I think making the setting a character in its own right is something that I always tend to do with my writing and definitely wanted to do here. Definitely a lot of times the things are built around that. But there were a few different things that really inspired this book. One of them was I started writing this in the beginning of 2020. And I am a mother of, at that time, a two-year-old son. Now I have two small children and a third one on the way. And things were really, the pandemic started and I was like watching my two-year-old in between Zoom meetings. Things at work were very precarious and not going well. And I was really stressed. I think that economic anxiety, it's really a driving force for the heroine in this book. It's really taking care of her family really motivates almost everything that she does. And I think that's where a little bit of my personal life probably crept in there. And actually, the very same day I sent the first draft of this novel to my agent, I was laid off from my job. And so I was sort of like, you know, the very opening pages of this book, the heroine loses her job on a movie. And then this whole plot unveils. And I was like, what did I do? Did I make this happen for myself? It's just like one of those truth is stranger than fiction moments. So on a personal level, like that definitely inspired it. And then also, like, I think the time I was writing this book and still on the national stage, it's just this incredibly politically polarized environment. And so when I was, as a historical fiction writer, sort of looking to the past to kind of understand that moment, like when, what other time periods were like this? And I think 1960s Italy, I mean, what an incredibly fraught environment. You know, after World War II, Italy switched sides during the war. And so you had families and neighbors that were really torn apart by that. They found themselves on opposite sides of it. And I think bringing that, what was happening on the national stage, and making it really domestic and personal really appealed to me. And I think was something that I thought a lot of people could really relate to. So, you know, looking at what happened when Sylvia's, that's the heroine's mother, Elena, has to, you know, reunite with her estranged sister many years later, who had this falling out during the war, and examining what that looked like was something that really motivated this book.
Yeah, it really captures that time period and that sort of like that paranoia and like bubbling resentment, like provides like some really good like gothic atmosphere for the story that's like gonna unfold here. I'm really interested in the historical aspects that you mentioned, and maybe like the kinds of research that it inspired, in particular about Cinecittà, the Rome movie studio, because that was a real studio. And I'm sure that like those studios produce like all sorts of sources and stuff like that, and like the time period in particular. So I'm wondering, like, what was your historical research like?
Yeah, great question. I would say one of my favorite primary sources, or one of my favorite sources for the research here, was actually a memoir called My Life with Cleopatra, by one of the producers of that film, about the making of Cleopatra, which was filmed, you know, at that studio, as well as on location around Italy in 1963. And it was just full of all of the kind of detail that I needed about making movies, because it was from the producer's perspective. So he was really talking about all the you know, crazy things that went into making that movie happen. And that movie in particular was like a phenomenally expensive production, was beset with an enormous amount of drama, and was also, this was really the genesis of paparazzi culture too. The stars of that movie, you know, were embroiled in a very public affair, Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. And so the idea of stars no longer, you know, being entitled to their privacy anymore, I thought was really interesting. And like, especially in a book like mine, where everyone's trying to keep secrets, I thought that was like a really fun tension to play with. But anyway, that book had, especially like the post-war details I was alluding to, like one example, I remember reading, they were renting a beach to film Cleopatra, and it was still mined from when the Allied troops had landed on that beach. And so they had to like clear the mines, to shoot this scene for Cleopatra. And so, I mean, just the scars that were still, present in Italy during this time period, you know, and the fact that American tourists are just swooping in and, you know, going to the beach and making movies, and just like that kind of, you know, there's still so much that's being healed, and things are just forging ahead at this rapid pace, I thought was really interesting. But also, you mentioned you were a medieval scholar, which is incredible. One of my majors in college was classical studies. And so I actually spent 6 months in Italy, Greece, and Turkey, traveling. I know, it was incredible. Traveling around, visiting all the museums and archaeological sites. But it was just such a funny contrast. Don't quiz me on any of that. I forget everything. I used to know so much, but it's all gone. But we had to like piece together just like such obscure clues about these ancient civilizations, like from shards of pottery, from like fragments of, you know, texts that had survived. And then in the 1960s, it's like, you can talk to people, you can read books, you can watch movies. It was just like an embarrassment of riches in contrast. Like my father has a colleague who is Italian and was in Rome in the 1960s. And he had an observation that, you know, brawls, like political brawls in the street, were just like commonplace. And that was a detail that actually made it into the book. And that was like someone's first person observation, which you can't really do that with ancient Rome. So that was a big difference.
I like, so you build mood so well in this story. And it really, I think I had described, like I've described it several times as like reading a Hitchcock movie. Like if, you know, like it is very cinematic and it is a book about a movie. And it, but it does feel like it does have that suspense quality. Can you talk a little bit about like how you kept that mood so genuine?
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate that. I'm a big Hitchcock. I mean, I love Hitchcock movies, so like that probably was no accident. I don't think it was something I did consciously, but I'm very familiar with Hitchcock's work. And actually, some of my favorite Hitchcock movies, I alluded to this a little bit earlier. I was like putting together a list of some of my favorite classic movies for my publisher for like a for a blog post. And I was looking at them and I was like really struck by something that a lot of them have in common is they were set almost entirely in one location. So like Dial M for Murder, Rear Window, both take place in an apartment for almost the entire movie because they Dial M for Murder was adapted from a stage play. And another one of my favorites that's not Hitchcock, Wait Until Dark, with Audrey Hepburn, which I think is one of the best works of psychological suspense ever created. Absolutely incredible movie. Also, like set almost entirely in her apartment. And then The Haunting, it's like another, you know, the 1963 version of The Haunting. It's also set in this, like, you know, in this case, fabulous house. But I think all of these, like the setting becomes a character and it becomes a figure in the plot. And so I think having that to kind of ground the story can kind of help it in a way in terms of like maintaining that suspense. So I think, you know, definitely that atmosphere and like really relying on that atmosphere to help with that, I think is really important.
For you, do you see like atmosphere and pacing work together? Because I feel like especially for this kind of story, like the tension of like information being revealed and information being obscured, like that kind of dance between becomes like really important, you know, because like as you're answering some mysteries, like more get launched, you know, and it's sort of like the questions kind of keep you moving forward. Like, was pacing also on your mind?
Yeah, I think pacing is something that honestly, like I'm trying to think how to answer this, but I will just say, like, when I first, you know, signed with my agent, the book I signed with my agent for was my fourth book. And I think getting pacing right, I think is the number one thing when you're learning your craft as a writer that you initially just get very wrong. Like I would say almost every writer writing their first book, the flaw is going to be the pacing. It's just it's really hard to figure out. And so I don't have a great answer except that it just took me a few books to figure out how to do it right. And I think I also just you know, I have these moments in my mind that I'm writing toward and kind of like keep give me momentum. I talked about this recently, but there's talk about plotters and pantsers and in on social media about, you know, what your writing style is and whether you plot it out in advance or you just like write by the seat of your pants. And there's actually a very prolific author, V.E. Schwab, who did The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue and Shades of Magic series. And she's just incredibly talented. She's my age and has published like 20 books, which, you know, try not to think about that. But so she described a connect the dots writer, where you have kind of these big moments that you're writing toward. And so that's really how I maintain my own momentum as a writer is I'm like really excited to kind of to get to these tentpole moments. And so I'm like waiting for those reveals. And I think maybe that helps me get the pacing right.
So that's a really I really like that description of writing, you know, because I think that that's kind of really important to have those goalposts set in motion, and then it's like something like the story moves towards them almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I was I had to write an outline for my third book with Kensington, which I'd never done before. And I was so nervous because like once I put it, those moments down on the page, I was worried that I would kind of lose my momentum because they really keep me going. I've been able to get over it for this one, but I do kind of like to keep it in my head and make myself actually write the book to like to get the pleasure of those moments for myself.
I would love to talk a little bit more about how the book plays with the giallo genre, because like it is a gothic story, but it's portraying like the production of a like this particular kind of Italian horror film. Yeah. And there are mirrors kind of between like what's happening to Sylvia and what's happening to the character that she's playing in the movie being filmed. But what to me, like the big difference is that like, so even like Giallo is about like women's perspectives, but it was often very like exploitative of them, you know, both in its depiction and how it like treated the actresses playing them. But the book isn't, right? Like it doesn't put Sylvia through like the same torments that like the protagonist of a giallo film would be. So I'm like kind of wondering like what that means about your approach to genre. Like, do you see it situated firmly in gothic, or do you kind of see genre as like a banquet that you can like pick and choose from, you know? Like,
ooh, that's fun. I like the idea of being able to pick and choose. I will say the particular blend of genres in this book, you know, I think it's part gothic suspense, part women's fiction, historical fiction. Like it's kind of bringing all of these things together. So I don't think it was really adhering to like the conventions of one specific genre. Like it has to be absolutely this. Like I think what I was hoping to do with this, and I hope this is the case, is like this is absolutely a book that's fit for your book club, but I also think it's a great beach read. And I think like sometimes that's what we need. Like we want to look at themes that are actually somewhat weighty, but we need to look at them maybe not quite head on. We need to like be able to process them in a way that's a little more approachable. Mm-hmm. And that's what I actually think is really interesting about the gothic, is you're like looking at the real through the lens of the unreal. And so that's like helping you kind of filter it and process it and giving you like that sense of catharsis. So, you know, you have, maybe there's a ghost, there's a witch in the movie that's being filmed. And so these like societal fears, you have this lens into them. That's not reality. But I did really enjoy the, you know, the movie being filmed within the book did let you play with that blurring of, you know, reality and unreality. It's sort of like, is this blood real or is this part of the set? And that's definitely, you know, part of the gothic trope, which I definitely wanted to play with that. I think it's really fun. But to your point about women and how they're portrayed, I have a lot of thoughts about this. Like, I don't want to go on too long of a monologue here, but this was actually really central to what I was trying to do. So within the movie being filmed, within the book, the director, you know, has this vision that the witch represents, you know, carnal sin, basically, and the young ingenue has to resist her and then have this white wedding at the end. And this was a really common horror movie theme, was, you know, people in the 1960s especially were afraid of the destruction of the nuclear family. They were afraid of the empowered sexual woman. And so it was really important to me to like show that that was the theme the director was trying to do, but have all of the female characters in the book be in contradiction to that. So they're all like really pressing against their patriarchal confines. And, you know, this is a spicy book and that's important. I think that's thematically important. We're seeing that Sylvia is, you know, in power of her sexuality in real life. She's also a young, unwed, single mother who doesn't have, you know, a man supporting her. Her own mother was widowed young and raised her by herself. And then we have Lucrezia, her bombshell co-star, who is just has a very active dating life. She's very ambitious. You know, so these are women that are really in control of themselves and like and defying the patriarchy. And so I think that's really a key tension of the book, is what happens to these women. And it's exploring, you know, when they're defying these confines, you know, what happens to them and how do they navigate that?
Can we talk about the guys? Because, whoa, like, you know, the contrast is just so beautifully done. So would you like to talk about them as well?
Yes, absolutely. So I think, well, the character of Terrence Leopold, he is her lecherous, drunk, very famous, very handsome co-star, inspired by a long tradition of predatory men in Hollywood, unfortunately. But and there were so many real examples to look at when I was researching this. I mean, you know, I don't want to get into too much of it, but like one that comes to mind is like Singing in the Rain with, you know, Debbie Reynolds. You know, she said she was just like bullied by Gene Kelly like the whole time, and he was really, really mean to her. And so I definitely like had that in my mind. And also, I think people going into this type of book might think, oh wow, that the hot famous co-star is definitely going to be her love interest. And I wanted to also subvert that expectation by showing he's definitely not. He's not a nice guy. And you know, to the themes I was talking about earlier of just like what women have to, you know, to put up with. And I think he was kind of important to show, you know, what Sylvia had to go through and was coming up against. And then the director himself is a bully in a very different way. He's very kind of like childlike, likes to push people's buttons. And he was, there was another memoir I read, The Girl on the Balcony by Olivia Hussey. She talks about her audition and how he was, the director was flicking little pieces of paper at her to get a real emotional reaction out of her. And that really stuck in my head. I was like, oh, that's the kind of bully that he is. He's just a needler. And I have a version of that was actually mentioned in Lucrezia's audition. So we have some really not nice guys. And then we have Paul, who is the love interest. And I really liked him as a foil to Sylvia. You know, she's very impulsive. He's like a little bit more measured and logical. And I just thought he was a nice contrast to her, a nice balance for her. I definitely was envisioning Robert Redford in my head when I was writing him, I'm not gonna lie. There's quite an interesting mix of guys in the book.
I really love like the way that many, I think, of the relationships are subverted from what your expectations are, because I found that my personal expectations were subverted with Sylvia's relationship with Lucrezia as well. You know, like there's it's a lot more nuanced than I was really expecting from the way that Lucrezia is, you know, sort of appears via reputation first, you know, and like that's a really interesting journey as well. And I also want to talk about you know, the relationship of Sylvia and her mother and her child, because there's a really lovely like three generations of women sort of living together and supporting each other, where even like there are very sweet moments where like the two-year-old gets to sort of like unknowingly emotionally support her mom, you know, like, and it's just like, it's very sweet in all directions. So could you also talk about them a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So starting with the Lucrezia question, I definitely, that was another relationship where I think your expectation is that they're going to come in and be, you know, catty and competitive with each other. And I really didn't want that. I wanted them to actually be good friends. And I also, I think, you know, having that female friendship was important to me. And I also wanted Lucrezia in there, I think, as, you know, a contrast to Gabriella in a way, because Gabriella was also very ambitious. But the way that she pursued her ambition had a lot of repercussions. And, you know, I think this book really explores, you know, duty versus personal desire. And when those come into conflict, you know, how do you navigate that? And when are your decisions problematic? And I wanted Lucrezia there to show ambition isn't like bad in and of itself. It's what you do to get it. Mm-hmm. You know, we see like Gabriella's growth around that, but Lucrezia, I just wanted to show like, this is a woman who knows what she wants. She's going for it. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. She, you know, there's no conflict for her around that. So that was another thing I wanted to do with Lucrezia's character. In terms of, you know, of Elena and Sylvia and Lulu, you know, I really wanted to show, I think the theme there, and, you know, for Gabriella as well, is the lengths that people will go to for their family. And I think, you know, Elena and Sylvia really have common values in that way, that they will put family loyalty above everything. And so, like, even though she has tension with her mom, ultimately her mom is there for her. You know, she got pregnant as a teenager and her mom was there for her. She moved in with her. She came to help take care of her baby. You know, she's been doing her best to raise her by herself for many years. And so I think Sylvia definitely, like, is modeling that behavior with her own daughter, and just, like, really will do anything for her. And I wanted to show that. And again, like, Gabriella has some growth, so I don't want to spoil anything.
I thought just the whole thing with, you know, just like the whole meeting with Gabriella was so well done too. You know, like, I, it's not like something I really want to talk about it, but I also don't, because it's like a big part of the book, you know, like she's another one, like, you meet her by reputation first and then you meet her, and then it's like this, like, it's just you really, like, you know, it's like you can kind of feel where Sylvia is coming from with everything, where she finds out things, like, she might not be what she was expecting, but then she's like, she finds out things about her and she's not really enthusiastic about those things.
Yeah,
you know, but she was a really interesting character that had, like, lore in a very short amount of time, and then you meet her, and then it's just like this is where the Hitchcockian thing just kind of comes in. It was just, like, so good.
Yeah, I definitely, that, you know, is another one where it was sort of like she didn't really go in with, like, negative expectations, despite her mom saying, don't talk to her, we don't, like, she's out of our lives. I think her curiosity trumped that, and her own tensions with her mother made her really question, like, how, you know, whether this was really founded. And then I think she goes in and she finds out, oh, okay, there were some reasons why they are estranged. But I also, you know, with Gabriella, I wanted, you know, going back to, like, the personal duty, or duty versus desire, I think we see Sylvia become more sympathetic with her over the course of the book. Because, like, Sylvia's, you know, initially, like, those are not in conflict for her. It's like, I'm going to be a star. This is my way to make money and care for my family. So I get to do what I want to do, and it's the right thing to do. But I think as the book progresses, there are times where maybe that's, like, not totally clear that that's still true. And so I think she starts to maybe gain some understanding for Gabriella's choices.
Yeah, we just loved this book so much. Thank you for joining us. This has been absolutely delightful. Yes. All right, listeners, please pick up Woman in the Castello. By the time that you hear this, it will be available. So head right over to your favorite bookstore or library, wherever you like to get your books. Thank you again. It is time to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.